So the question I would like for us to think about from the Word of God is glory from man or God. And there is this couple of verses in John 12, verse 42-43, where essentially what we have is that there were those who were listening to Jesus, and apparently they really got into his message, except they were afraid. They were afraid of the Pharisees, and they wanted to be held in good count by them. So as the passage indicates, John 12, 42, nevertheless, many, even of the authorities, believed in him. But for fear of the Pharisees, they did not confess it, so that they would not be put out of the synagogue, for they loved the glory that comes from man more than the glory that comes from God. I don't know about you. I don't know that I would ever want that to be an assessment made about me, for any of us. That's not at all what we would look at. But this is exactly a very practical point, because in their day and time, being kicked out of the synagogue was essentially being kicked out of society and the culture they knew. So it wasn't just going to church, as we might say that, but they saw this as a part of their entire world. It affected everything. But still, the bottom line, as we're seeing here in John 12, 42, 43, is that they were more afraid of people than they were of God, and they were more impressed by people than they were of God. And so that's the result. In Galatians chapter 1, a lengthier passage, Galatians 1, starting in verse 6, going through verse 10, we have Paul as he addresses the Galatian churches. And when he addresses them, the problem is apparently the fact that there were Judaizing people. There were those who were teaching, essentially, that they had to become Jews to become good Christians, which seems so ironic to us. And I think to the apostles, it was not just ironic, it was wrong, but as they deal with this, as Paul in the book of Romans, in Galatians, even the writer of Hebrews addresses the inadequacies, the failures of Judaism, of the Mosaic law. I mean, as a matter of fact, the writer of Hebrews is probably as plain as they get, where he just says in chapter 10 that the blood of bulls and goats cannot save anyone. It's the sacrifice that God has offered himself. So why would anybody want to go back? Well, to them, it wasn't going back to involve themselves with every single aspect of the old law. It was circumcision. And that's why Paul spends quite a bit of time in a number of his books indicating that baptism is circumcision. We read that this morning in our Bible study from Romans 4 and the connection that Paul makes also in Colossians 2, that circumcision now is the putting off of the body of sin by baptism into the very death of Jesus. So all that to say that Paul in the book of Galatians is dealing very much with Judaizing teachers who are bringing that heresy into the church, or at least trying to. And so as we begin our reading in verse 6 and go through verse 10, he says, "I am astonished that you are so quickly deserting him who called you in the grace of Christ and are turning to a different gospel, not that there is another one." This is kind of the same difficult phrasing that we find in 1 Corinthians, where Paul says that there is no other God, even though there are other gods and lords. It sounds like there is another gospel. Paul says, no, there is no other actual gospel, but there are some who trouble you, and they want to distort the gospel of Christ. But even if we, or an angel from heaven — and this is a great passage when talking to somebody who believes in Mormonism or is talking about Mormonism, because this is a little bit of an irony that Joseph Smith, do a real quick history lesson, was about the same time period as Alexander Campbell. Actually, Smith wanted very much to not just meet Campbell, but to do everything Campbell did. That's why there are a lot of Mormon churches, even to this day, that identify as the Church of Jesus Christ. And then there's that last phrase of Latter-day Saints. I mean, there was a connection between Smith and Campbell in that regard. What I was going to say is that Smith's entire ideology, his foundation to this whole Mormon thing, is that an angel said this, an angel. Paul says that even if an angel from heaven should preach to you a gospel that is contrary to the one we preach to you, let him be accursed. He doesn't say, look, if an angel comes, then, hey, you got to listen to him. Because if it's an angel, it's an angel. He doesn't say anything dumb like that. It's even if an angel came and preached a gospel that is not what we have preached, because it is the one, then let him be accursed. As we've said before, verse 9, so now I say again, if anyone is preaching to you a gospel contrary to the one you received, let him be accursed. For am I now seeking the approval of man or of God? Or am I trying to please man? If I were still trying to please man, I would not be a slave of Christ. And he'll go on talking about things like that. But it's very easy to see that Paul's saying, look, we're not trying to make people happy. We're trying to do what God is saying. Now, it's not that, I know saying a statement like that is like, so religion is supposed to be a lot of unhappiness, right? A lot of anger. No, not necessarily, but there is this understanding that life is difficult, life is challenging. It's any person, whether you accept that God exists or not, life is tough under the sun. I mean, that's Solomon's great point in the book of Ecclesiastes. That's why I've suggested a number of times that Ecclesiastes is a really good book to use in trying to study about God with somebody who may not know anything about the Bible. The argument that Solomon makes is life under the sun. It's over and over that phrase, but his conclusion is up front. Vanity of vanity, says the preacher, all is vanity. When you start looking at life, its injustices, its tragedies, its problems, you've got to come up with some kind of a solution. And it's either, as the atheist might say, that, well, there is no God, and that's the result, and anybody who's basically trying to be religious is just ignoring all the facts, or if you look at what God is saying through his word, and consistently through his word, there's better hope. If Jesus came to the earth, and I don't mind kind of chasing the rabbit here for the moment, if the Lord himself came claiming to be the Son of God and had this perfect life, and however you assess a perfect life, I think that's highly challenging. He came born of a poor family. We know his poverty and the family's poverty because of the sacrifice when he was to be circumcised. The law basically said you're supposed to do this, or if you're poor, you do this. Well, they did the poor thing. And so with that, you know, he's born into a poor family. He's not born in nobility. He is not got a very easy life at the age of 30 to 33. It's when in John 8, 9, and 10, he's addressing the Jews, and they say, you're not even 50. Have you met Abraham? I'm just using that as evidence, maybe, that he looked older than he actually was. You know, no big surprise if he had a hard life. But the very Son of God was crucified. So that's part of, I think, a good argument against atheism is the fact that God doesn't come preaching a message of warm, good, happy, everything's perfect. You know, become a Christian, it'll just all work out. As a matter of fact, even with Paul, the Apostle Paul became a Christian, his life got very hard. You could read in 2 Corinthians 11 of everything he endured. For what reason? What purpose? Being a follower of Jesus. So I think somewhat, and I'm just saying the speculation is that with Judaizing teachers, not only were they extremely familiar with Judaism and Mosaic law, I mean, it wasn't just a religion, it was their actual way of life in every respect, but also the fact that it's not just the familiarity point, that's really what I'm trying to say, but also, if you think about New Testament evidence, Christians suffered more at the hands of Jews than they did any other political group. Now, outside the Bible, as the Bible ends toward the first century, going into the second century, basically Rome does pay a lot more attention to Christians. But it's really in the Bible, you read about Jews who really came at Christians. So if you're a Christian and you're Jewish, you're thinking, well, it's safer to be a Jewish Christian than to be a Gentile. They had a hard time accepting them. But in this region of Galatia, if you don't know where that is, it would be from where Israel is. You look on a map in your mind and go northwest, more north than west is this huge area of Galatia. There are a number of churches in those towns. That is where the influence of these Jews were. It wasn't close to Jerusalem at all. It was very far away. And yet they were trying to get people to do something different than the gospel actually taught. So Paul's question, am I trying to please people or please God? God's way is the harder way. What does Jesus say in Matthew 7, 13, 14? You've got a broad way that leads to destruction, and there are many who go by it. It's an easy way. But there's this straight, narrow, this difficult way. The gate is small, he says. It is a way that leads to life. But again, straight, narrow, difficult. And he says there are few who find it. And as I often remind us, fewer take it. Are we trying to please men or God? Are we trying to make people happy and feel good when there may not be a reason to feel good? Can you imagine going to a doctor, being told that you have cancer, and then they say, well, what do you want to do about that? I don't want to have cancer. You know, I want to be healed. Well, how would you like to do this? You're there to find out from the doctor what they're going to do. If he's giving you all the options, you're like, look, here's, you know, when you go to doctors and things, they have for the kids. It's not really for the adults. They have a lollipop sitting there. Can you imagine the doctor going to an adult who's suffering from cancer? Here, just take a lollipop. You know, one of your favorites. Whatever flavor you like, that's the best, and you're good. Okay. We all know how dumb that is. And yet that's spiritually somewhat the scenario that people have religiously. Health and wealth. You love God, God's going to love you right back. You give him a dollar, he'll give you 10. I've heard the televangelists say things like that, this 10% thing. You give him, he gives back tenfold. Okay, was Jesus a very wealthy man? No. Did he suffer? Tremendously. So if the Son of God went through all that, why are we ever surprised that we go through trouble? One, but two, why are we having this full expectation that things are just going to be easy? It's not an accurate assessment of Christianity. Look with me in John 5. Jesus speaking here. John 5. And we'll go verse 42 through 47 as I have there before you. John 5, 42. This is after that great series of statements from about verse 25 through 29 where he speaks about he himself being given by God life. Verse 25. We'll go ahead and read that since we're in that neighborhood. Truly, truly, I say to you, an hour is coming and is now here when the dead will hear the voice of the Son of God and those who hear will live. For as the Father has life in himself, which means he's not like you and me where outside of us life is given. He has life in himself. He exists. He's always existing. So he has granted the Son also to have life in himself. He's given him authority to execute judgment because he's the Son of Man. Do not marvel at this. An hour is coming when all who are in the tombs will hear his voice and come out, and those who've done good to the resurrection of life, those who've done evil to the resurrection of condemnation. And he goes on, I can't do anything on my own. As I hear, I judge. My judgment is just, because I seek not my own will, but the will of him who sent me. And he goes on with that, and as we pick this up in verse 42, we read there, I know that you do not have the love of God within you. I've never understood when folks think that Jesus was just some big spiritual pushover, that he just tried to please everybody. I know I've mentioned this a lot more recently, where in Matthew 15, after Jesus calls them all hypocrites, well did Isaiah speak of you? You know, they were paying, well, I'm conflating Matthew 23 now, but in Matthew 15 it had everything to do with the washing of hands. The disciples weren't washing hands. And it was the tradition of the elders. And you remember Jesus says, well, you have a fine way of just ignoring the commands of God. Well, after all that, in Matthew 15, that's when the disciples come to Jesus. Do you know what you said offended them? And his response, I think we need to remember, is then let them be offended. We live in the time, and it's not just now, it's been going on for decades, where we just don't want to hurt anybody's feelings over anything. And it's going to happen. If we teach the truth can be offensive. Well, we teach the truth, and it's not in an effort to be offensive just for the sake of that, but someone's feelings may be hurt, okay? Would you rather hurt somebody's feelings and save their souls, or not hurt their feelings and condemn them? I mean, by just not teaching the truth. Speak the truth in love is Ephesians 4:15. We need to do that, but Jesus here doesn't say something easy. I know that you do not have the love of God within you. Now, we didn't start off there, and I just want to show you this in verse 18, because this is who he's talking to. This is why the Jews were seeking all the more to kill him, Because not only was he breaking the Sabbath by healing, he was even calling God his Father, making himself equal with God. So Jesus doesn't try to clarify things and say, look, I don't know how in the world you got that in your brain. He doesn't correct it because it doesn't need correcting. And that's the audience that he says, I know you don't have the love of God within you. I have come in my Father's name, and you do not receive me. If another comes in his own name, you'll receive him. How can you believe when you receive glory from each other and do not seek the glory that comes from the only God? Do not think that I will accuse you to the Father. There is one who accuses you, Moses, on whom you've set your hope. For if you believed Moses, you would believe me, because he wrote of me. But if you do not believe his writings, how will you believe my words? I don't know about you. That's pretty direct. I mean, that's very direct. Again, his statement to an audience who already is against him. They're wanting, it's not that we start in this section in verse 18 that some of these Jews didn't really like him. It says that these Jews were seeking all the more to kill him. Obviously, if you want to kill somebody, you've got to have not just violence in your mind and in your heart, but how does somebody who looks at you that way look at you? They don't look at you with a smile in their face and a gleam in their eye. They look at you not just glaring, but I mean, they're wanting to kill you. And he's saying things like this, I know you don't have the love of God within you. And the one who's going to accuse you before God is not me. It's going to be Moses, because Moses wrote about me. I mean, that's what he says very plainly, verse 46. If you believe Moses, you'd believe me. He wrote of me. If you don't believe his writings, how will you believe my words? So, you have that. I want to talk for a few minutes, because we did start off in John 12, 42, 43 with those Jews who were just afraid of the Pharisees and how they might be affected. They were seeking the glory of man more so than the glory of God. And we talk about peer pressure, and I think very plainly, peer pressure, we think, happens to kids. It's a kid thing. But the truth is, obviously, adults suffer from this too. People suffer from it. We don't want to be in a crowd that thinks one way and we're thinking an entirely different way, which, by the way, is how I think the world is right now. It seems like the world's kind of lost its collective mind in some ways. I know they've done different experiments with people, whether kids or adults, where they put them in a room with a bunch of people and they tell the one person, look, this is, you know, what we're going to tell you. And they tell them some truth, that the walls are white, eggshell white. And then they tell the group, without telling the one that they're telling, that you need to argue with this guy that this is beige. At best, it's beige. There is no white. And they do that. And after a while, almost always, statistically it's quite high, that the one person, because of the influence of all these others saying it's beige, finally concludes it's beige. It's not too far from the truth, but it's far enough. What changed? Simply the fact that a lot of people were saying it's beige. And maybe getting even angry and evil about how this is. You think if that's all it's about, peer pressure affects us all. So when at work, you know, everybody's maybe, you know, doing certain things that cheat the company, we think, well, we can get away with all that. Whatever that is. I can't say that I think about cheating companies, you know, and things like that. But still, if that's what everybody else is doing, and sometimes that's the argument people make about things, right? Well, everybody else is doing this. Are you not going to do this? You're not going to join in? You know, there are all kinds of different applications in that regard. Just because everyone else is doing it doesn't make it right. Remember the Smothers Brothers? I know that kind of ages me even. They weren't super popular when I was a kid. My dad really liked the Smothers Brothers, but they have this one act, if you might recall, that they're both talking about Jimmy Crack Corn and I Don't Care, and then they change the song, and he goes, why'd you do that? He goes, that guy out there told me to do that. And it's just a joke. And he goes, would you do anything he tells you? He goes, oh, well, not again. You know, if you were told to jump off a cliff, would you do that? Oh, well, not again, you know. It's just, it's, again, peer pressure. The idea that someone is pressuring you who is not God. So, anyway, let's look at two passages, Galatians 2 and Acts 26. In Galatians 2, which I know we turned away from Galatians 1, so we're going to go back to Galatians 2, Paul actually has to confront the Apostle Peter. Now, I know Peter gets a bad rap for a lot of different things, and probably in some ways it's justified. He is the one that, before the cock crowed that third time, had denied the Lord. But here, in Galatians 2, starting verse 11, Paul, in addressing, again, the Galatian Jewish influence, when Cephas, which is his Aramaic name, when Cephas came to Antioch, and this would be the Antioch further north and south, I opposed him to his face because he stood condemned. For before certain men came from James, he was eating with the Gentiles. But when they came, he drew back, separated himself, fearing the circumcision party. The apostle Peter, who's walked on water, by the way, done some really cool things, feared the circumcision party. What we read earlier there in John chapter 12, 42, 43 is exactly what it seems that he was afraid of. He was afraid of people. And I think it's just very surprising. Galatians 2 again, verse 12, certain men came from James. He, Peter, was eating with the Gentiles, and when they came, he drew back. So in verse 13, the rest of the Jews also acted hypocritically with him, so that even Barnabas was led astray by their hypocrisy. The son of encouragement, as the apostles had named him, even he pulls back. So Paul says in verse 14, when I saw that their conduct was not in step with the truth of the gospel, I said to Cephas before them all, if you, though a Jew, live like a Gentile and not like a Jew, how can you force the Gentiles to live like Jews? And he'll go on making arguments. We're justified by faith, not by works of the law. And again, it's a powerful scene, but it shows you the power of peer pressure, even among an apostle. Peter feared the circumcision party, and so he caved. And it influenced all of them, even to the degree that it influenced Barnabas. And then finally, Acts 26 with King Agrippa. Acts 26, in verses 19 through 32, as I have there. Acts 26, 19, I think it's through to the end of the chapter. And again, with the idea that we have here of peer pressure, of caving into people's ideas rather than God's. I've often read in different places, so I don't know the original source of the idea, that any man who stands with God alone is a majority. I mean, and it's a good thought. It doesn't matter if everybody in the world thinks something differently. I mean, Paul makes the argument, let every man be a liar. God's true. God is true no matter what. And when we stand before God in judgment, it's not going to be, well, everybody else was thinking this or everybody else was doing that, and God going, oh, well, if everybody else was doing it, we'll just change the law. I think that's part of the problem when people make arguments that culture has changed and therefore the truth of the gospel should change. Using the argument of homosexuality, they'll read the Bible. Well, that was the culture back then. Everything's changed now. No. Mankind is essentially the same. I mean, essentially the same. So here we are in Acts 26, 19. And like I said, we're going to read through to the end here. Paul's making his defense to the king. The king has Jewish influence. He knows the Jews. So when Paul speaks to him, he actually compliments him in that way. And he says in his defense, because he's in trouble, because the Jews have brought him to the king for the king to move him on. He's appealed to Caesar, by the way, which in Roman law meant you had to go. It wasn't a thing where you say, look, I want to take my case to the Supreme Court, and they go, okay, well, we'll do that, and a month or two later, you're like, I really don't want to do that. Okay, you can back out. If you said you wanted to stand before Caesar, you were going to stand before Caesar. It would take years, but still, you were. So in verse 19, O King Agrippa, therefore, Paul says, I was not disobedient to the heavenly vision, but declared first to those in Damascus, and then in Jerusalem, throughout all the region of Judea, even to the Gentiles, that they should repent and turn to God and perform deeds, keeping with their repentance. For this reason, the Jews seized me in the temple and tried to kill me. To this day, I've had the help that comes from God, so that I stand here testifying both to small and great, which he starts off indicating, definitely King Agrippa is great. But as he goes on in all this, he says, saying nothing but what the prophets and Moses said would come. Verse 23, that the Christ must suffer, and by that, being the first to rise from the dead, he would proclaim light both to our people and to the Gentiles. And as he was saying these things in his defense, Festus, who's the governor, said with a loud voice, and to be honest with you, I imagine this, he just interrupts Paul. Paul, you are out of your mind. The way we would say that is, you're crazy. Your great learning is driving you out of your mind. Paul said, I am not out of my mind, most excellent Festus. Shows you that even when you're being interrupted, don't, you know, treat the guy who's interrupting that bad. And then he goes on, I am speaking true and rational words, which he says that because he's been accused of being crazy. The king knows about these things, and to him I speak boldly. For I am persuaded that none of these things has escaped his notice, for this has not been done in a corner. This hasn't been done in some place that's, you know, hidden from everybody else. So he goes on in verse 27, notice, and this is the courage of Paul to be in this circumstance and use it as an opportunity to not just preach the gospel, but to bring it to a point, you know, we call this an invitation basically, you know. King Agrippa, do you believe the prophets? Now that's an interesting thing. I mean, he's just been interrupted by the governor. You're crazy. You're losing your brain. I haven't. I'm speaking very rational words. The king understands this has all been done in a way that nobody's hiding. And then he just flat out asks in front of everybody, just like we were reading there in John 12, 42, 43 with Jesus, do you believe the prophets? I know that you believe. And Agrippa responds. Now, I know the ESV says it a little differently. Most of these translations are going to say that you almost persuade me to become a Christian. The Greek is not really about that. It's about in a short time. If there were a little bit more time, that's really the point, that in a short time you would persuade me to be a Christian. And the ESV actually puts it as a question, like, are you thinking that it's not going to take long? So verse 27, King Agrippa, do you believe the prophets? I know you believe. Agrippa said to Paul, in a short time, would you persuade me to be a Christian? Paul said, whether short or long, I would to God that not only you, but also everyone who hears me this day would become such as I am, except for these chains. And so in this moment, it's not just King Agrippa, it's the governor Festus, it's everybody else who's there. Who all knows who all's there? But Paul doesn't say just for you or for the other, but for everybody. And that's a point that can be made even with Calvinists who speak of limited atonement. Paul didn't preach limited atonement here, y'all. He preached the gospel to Agrippa, to Festus, and whoever else was in the audience. You know, it's pretty interesting. So let's close these last three verses of the chapter. The king rose, and the governor, and Bernice, which is Festus's wife, and those who were sitting with him, and when they had withdrawn, they said to each other, this man is doing nothing that deserves death or even imprisonment. And Agrippa then said to Festus, this man could have been set free if he had not appealed to Caesar, which again, it was Roman law. And we might know the rest of the story with chapters 27 and 28. But peer pressure. King Agrippa, we don't know exactly why he rejects Paul, but the only person who was speaking the truth in this moment was Paul. The king, who's a king, the governor and his wife and all these others may have acted like they were neutral. Festus doesn't seem too neutral. And the rest are accusing Paul, but King Agrippa, if it was a one-on-one, who knows how that would have ended up? Don't know. It's speculation completely. Peer pressure. You know, you think of how powerful peer pressure can be in the negative, as we've kind of noticed in Galatians and Acts, but I don't have this in the outline, but in Ecclesiastes 4 and even in Daniel with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, I want to, with you real quick, turn to Ecclesiastes 4, because I do think this goes right along in a positive way. Excuse me, Ecclesiastes chapter 4, of having good friends. Friends who are going to hold you up when things are tough, if not even impossible. Ecclesiastes chapter 4, 9 through 12. Ecclesiastes 4, 9 through 12. Solomon says that two are better than one because they have a good reward for their toil. If they fall, one will lift up his fellow. But woe to him who's alone when he falls and does not have anyone to lift him up. Again, verse 11, if two lie together, they keep warm, but how can one keep warm alone? Though a man might prevail against one who is alone, two will withstand him, and a threefold cord is not quickly broken. Lord willing, when we get in our study of Daniel, we'll get to the story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, but I firmly believe that they on their own individually could have stood, you know, but how much easier it would have been for there to be others. And that's part of the reason why we come together to fellowship, not just in hearing me preach, if you will, but to see in the positive way, the most positive way, the encouragement that we can get. We each serve to some degree as a Barnabas to each other. I mean, that's kind of the point. It's not just that we in mind think, but we're here. Physically, we're here to be able to encourage each other in that regard. And so like we started off with, who are we trying to please? Are we trying to please God or man? Are we trying to get glory from men or from God? As the question from our title in John 12, 42, 43 comes. The song we have here as a song of encouragement, an invitation song, if you will, 687, Only a Step. That's where it starts. It's probably the hardest thing in doing what's right. It may be in your own mind you're thinking, I want to please God. I want to stand before God and be found innocent of all charge, if you will, all sins, to be clothed with Christ. In Galatians 3, baptism is where we are clothed with Christ. And with that in mind, as we stand before God, we either are going to be uniform with Him or we're not. We aren't going to stand on our own before Him in that way. It's going to be Christ who serves as our advocate, and not just for us. He is an advocate for all if we will obey. That's the point in 1 John 2. He died for everybody. Only a step. So in 687, if you will, right now, if you want to be baptized, you can come forward as we stand and sing.